Hi, everybody. In the long tradition of having unbelievable guests on my show, add this gentleman to that list. Today, I've got with us Richard Wrangham, who is just recently retired from Harvard. He was the Ruth B. Moore Professor of Biological Anthropology. Because I'm apparently a masochist, I went and checked his Google Scholar Citation Index and realized, to my dismay, that he has an H index of 111. For those of you who don't know, that is an extraordinary reflection of his influence. He's got three books. I mean, he's got some edited books, but I'll discuss the ones that he's authored rather than edited. Demonic Males, Apes, and the Origin of Human Violence with Dale Peterson. Catching Fire, How Cooking Made Us Human. And his most recent book, released last year, The Goodness Paradox, How Evolution Made Us Both More and Less Violent. How are you, sir?
I'm good. And yourself?
Very good. So maybe we should start. You told me this before we got on air, that you just recently retired. How has it been so far? It's only been about a month or two. Are you pleased? Are you regretful? Give us your state of mind.
Well, you know, I'm hearing from everybody who is teaching on campus at the moment, or not necessarily on campus, that it's pretty difficult making the transition to teaching remotely. And I feel pretty happy to be able to move back to, you know, it's like being a graduate student again. I can actually, you know, do research and writing on the things I want to do rather than having all those administrative responsibilities and others. So, you know, it's a blast. I'm really looking forward to more of this.
So that's what I guess you already answered my next question, which is you're not retiring to become a surfer. All that retirement means for you is that you don't have to do the administration, you don't have to do the teaching, but you're likely probably have a long queue of projects that you're working on that you'll probably work on for many more years. Is that the general idea?
Yes, exactly. That's right. I doubt if I'll ever become a really great surfer, you know, so I just have to give that one up.
Got it. By the way, I thought that I had two of your books. You were very kind to send me an e-copy of your most recent book, which I've only very quickly perused through it. But I do have your original one. Here we go.
Oh, okay.
And for some, both my wife and I put my wife on this task. We were trying to look for the cooking book, which I am certain I have it, but I have a very, very big personal library. So it is hidden somewhere, but it's another fantastic book which people should read. So, Richard, I thought we would start with, as I told you before we started, you know, you're someone who, because of your long, illustrious career in evolutionary theory, you've interacted with many of the historical figures that really have seeped their way outside of, you know, just the rarefied world of academia. Some of these people have become sort of cultural icons, Diane Fossey, Jane Goodall, to a lesser extent, Bill Hamilton, but certainly he's a giant as a scientist. Any cool stories that people would not have learned about these people that you'd like to, that you feel comfortable sharing with us?
Well, I don't know if I've got any sort of stories exactly about them. You know, I've got huge admiration for them. You know, I mean, they were pioneers, all of them. And Jane Goodall, goodness, I mean, she is what, 86? And she continues. I mean, she's writing and talking up a storm at the moment. You know, she and Diane Fossey had this very big influence, I think, in terms of helping to push people in the direction of thinking about the conservation of great apes.
Right.
And I, you know, I love that. Diane had an attitude that certainly was totally out of date and in many ways, you know, really problematic. And she showed me her practice of whipping poachers with nettles. And, you know, so we had a big row about that. And I in the end, found a great friendship with her, falling by the wayside, you know, because of that.
Wow.
But because of her passion.
Right.
You know, and there she was, you know, living quite a long time on her own in circumstances that were very difficult, that she'd experienced human violence herself.
Yeah.
when she was taken into custody by soldiers in the Congo. And she saw violence done to the guerrillas. And, you know, she was a flawed human being, let's put it that way, you know. And, I mean, what Jane always says about chimpanzees, you know, when, I mean, for the first several years of working with chimps, she was really tremendously impressed with their affiliation, their loving relationships, their strong positive emotions. And then, of course, it turned out, during the time I happened to be there, that the chimps are capable of going off on ventures into the neighboring territories where they kill members of neighboring groups when they can. And what she did was to emphasize the fact that this in some ways just made them more sympathetic as a species, because it made them flawed in the same way that humans are.
Right, interesting. So how do people, I mean, you know, you've got all these great primatologists who dedicate their lives to studying one particular species. As someone who studies decision-making, psychology of decision-making, it always interests me, why do people make the choices that they do, whether which medical specialty they decide to specialize in or whatever. So is there any insight as to how each of these great primatologists chose the particular species that they wanted to focus on? Whether it be great apes or other, you know, vervet monkeys or rhesus monkeys or baboons or, you know, bonobos or chimps or orangutans, is it really just an affiliation that you feel for that particular species, or in your case, what was it? And maybe you could link it to some of the other choices that other primatologists have made.
Well, you know, the sort of the worthy answer would be that you're interested in a problem, you survey the world and you say, that is the species for me. You know, I'm sure there are people for whom that's true, but I think much more often it is chance.
Right.
And so for me, when I left college, I was at Oxford University, uncertain of what to do. My tutor, who was responsible for my academic development, said, well, guess what? My daughter is going off to study chimpanzees with Jane Goodall. Why don't you write to Jane Goodall?
Oh, wow. Okay. So serendipity, basically.
Total serendipity. Exactly. That's right.
Very interesting.
And I think that's quite often true. But I think, you know, what's impressive is that if you spend a few months, for whatever reason, with a particular species of wild, maybe generally animal, but particularly primates, it is hard to ever leave, because the, you know, it just becomes so fascinating. And of course, the longer you stay, then the more interesting it is, because the soap opera becomes so much more real.
Right.
You know, the daily changes in social relationships or interactions that tweak social relationships become so much more meaningful once you become a member of that society, as it were. And it's the same in anthropology. You know, I mean, people go off and study a particular group in, you know, wherever it is in the world, and they find it very difficult to leave, because they are then the people who can translate what's going on to the rest of the world. So, you know, my general attitude is that it's serendipity that leads you there, and the fascination that keeps you.
Interesting. You know, as someone who has a, well, I think it's an adaptive phobia of mosquitoes, I always marvel at the capacity of folks to go doing field work in places where, to me, I would do anything to avoid those places, because they seem as though they are one big infested mosquito ecosystem. So is this a fair assessment of one of the requirements of being a, you know, field primatologist, which is you better not have phobias of insects, right?
Well, I mean, these field sites vary a lot, of course. The worst insects, worst attack mosquitoes I've ever had was in North America, in Yellowstone National Park, you know, where they really came in clouds. It's actually, you know, surprisingly easy dealing with the physical problems, I would say.
No kidding.
The one secret, actually, that people don't appreciate is that although the physical problems with regard to protecting yourself from dangerous animals is normally pretty good. There are definite issues with regard to following chimpanzees, with regard to physical condition. That is to say, that when you start following in a place like Gombe with a few hills, and it's true for most of the forests that chimpanzees are studied in, you have to be in very good physical nick to be able to keep up with them.
It's a young person's game, or a fit person's game.
It's a fit person's game, that's right. Yeah. But,
by the way, I
don't think that always comes across.
I don't know exactly why, but you're very patchy in terms of your the camera. Is there a way you can just adjust something?
What's happened with the camera?
Or maybe it's, I mean, I think the audio, I hear you well, but you're just very grainy. But in any case, that's part of the reality of...
Okay.
Don't worry about it. Speaking of insects, then we'll move on to the next topic. I think Bill Hamilton regrettably died of malaria. Am I getting that story right?
Yeah.
And now,
yeah, that's true.
Exactly. And I think he was trying to study the evolution and or the origins of the HIV virus. Is that right?
Yes, he had a hypothesis. He loved the hypothesis that HIV got into humans as a result of a failed experiment trying to control polio, actually. He went off to the Congo, and I saw him shortly before he went, because he wanted to, you know, get some tips, because I'd worked in the general area, and his aim was to go and collect fecal samples from chimpanzees and get some other kind of samples to detect whether or not the viruses that could be found harbored by the chimps would be particularly closely related to those that were responsible for HIV. And tragic that while there, you know, this person who would have understood better than anybody what was happening as the virus was passed from chimpanzees to humans, ended up killed by, well, not a virus, but a plasmodium.
Wow, incredible. I mean, well, a story that I love about Bill Hamilton, and I think I read it in the biography that Segastrale wrote of him, where she recounts, I think it was in that book that I read it, that when he was trying to defend his doctoral dissertation, I think at Oxford, the kin selection, basically, theory, no one wanted to touch that. No one wanted to support him. And so I always tell my students that if your work engenders animus, it's either because you are really, really wrong or really, really right, right? And in his case, that theory, I mean, now if you look at in terms of kin selection, I mean, I know there have been subsequent debates with E.O. Wilson and others, but I mean, it is a profoundly important framework. And it shows that doggedness and confidence in your ideas is something that you want to have as a scientist, right?
Yes. I only hesitate because I don't think of him as somebody who was out there defending his views particularly. I mean, you know, he let them speak for themselves to a very large extent.
Right.
And he didn't have to. I mean, other people came in and really defended them for him. I mean, Richard Dawkins, you know, was his bulldog in some ways, but also George Williams and actually Ed Wilson in the early days. He had his very strong defenders, and what I rather sort of liked, I suppose, about Bill was that he didn't get stuck in that area. He went on being totally creative in all sorts of wacky ways, and some of them were probably a little bit too wacky. I mean, he had these fascinating ideas about clouds as being evolved to transport bacterial spores, something like that.
Wow.
Which he was working on as he died, actually. There were all sorts of really interesting creative things about the adaptive colors of the fall leaves.
Now, would someone,
Okay.
I was going to say, would
Okay.
someone accuse him of being an ultra adaptationist in that he's, you know, it's adaptationism on steroids where you are trying to. The only reason I mention this is because you often hear that as an evolutionary psychologist when you provide a very compelling explanation for why something exists in its form in the human context, right away you get some person, typically a social scientist, saying, you know, you're succumbing to ultra adaptationism. So some of the examples that you gave, I don't know anything about them, but they seem as though they could potentially be prone to such an attack, right?
Yeah, I mean, it's probably a fair accusation, and I think my sense of Hamilton is that he would have defended that approach. I'm sure he wouldn't have been sort of willing to. I'm sure he would have been willing to see ideas thrown out, you know, if the data are appropriate, but you know, his basic intuition was indeed strongly adaptationist,
Yeah, beautiful.
and mine too.
One yeah, mine too. One last question on these sort of general kind of evolutionary gossip stories, and then we'll move on to some of the substantive stuff. You were at Harvard earlier in your career in the 70s, and then you joined in the late 80s. So you would have been smack in the middle of what was referred to as the culture wars, the battle between, you know, the E.O. Wilson types, you know, the social biology types, and Lewontin and Stephen Jay Gould, you know, who despised the application of evolutionary thinking to humans. Any thoughts or stories from that battle as someone who witnessed it from within the ecosystem?
I mean, I just wish I'd been at some of the faculty meetings of the Department of Biology at Harvard, you know, because Lewontin and Gould, of course, who took their fight into the New York Times and in other, you know, public venues, were sitting around the table with Ed Wilson and Ernst Mayr. So, you know, it was all a very local kind of family dispute. It was a pretty tense atmosphere, there was no question. I was there as a recently minted PhD, very surprised by all this degree of hostility, and very much wrapped up with a group that Erwin de Vore, the primatologist, had assembled around him, and who were all firmly adaptationists and very comfortable with Ed Wilson's sociobiology book, which was produced in 1975. I was there 76, 77. I found people, I mean, on one occasion, I think it was for real, Lewontin seemed to be walking around to get off the sidewalk in order to avoid coming face to face with people in the DeVore group. Even if he didn't actually intend that, it was the atmosphere was such that that was how it felt. You know, that it really divided people in terms of ordinary interpersonal interactions. But I think, you know, the sort of serious issues were. It's really sad because Lewontin and Gould were both intellectually terrific, but they really did let their attitude or their fears about misapplication of science interfere with their judgment.
Well, I was going to say that. I mean, that was exactly my next point, which is it demonstrates that scientists, while we'd like to presume that they are, you know, not prone to succumb to ideological biases and so on, this was a perfect manifestation of two very accomplished thinkers who, because of their, I would call them parasitic ideas, were unable to accept the application of evolutionary thinking to the human context. And so this demonstrates that we're all potentially susceptible to these types of biases. The fact that you're a scientist doesn't make you immune to such faulty thinking, right?
Yeah, no, that's right. And so, if you happen to be right, as you and I are, then the question is, can you constantly look over your shoulder and make sure that you're not making the mistakes that you're criticizing other people for.
True. Okay, so let's get into some of the big lines of your three books, and then we'll take little parentheses. So demonic males, the reason why I thought we should discuss it, well, first, it's a great book, but there's a term now that I often make fun of because it's part of the idea pathogens that I discuss in my forthcoming book, this idea of toxic masculinity, which in a sense pathologizes half of humanity. And then people will come back and say, no, you don't, Professor Saad, you don't understand what we mean by toxic masculinity. But so from your perspective, as someone who's actually, in a sense, written about toxic masculinity, right? How do you view your work in that book in light of that term? Are you familiar with the term toxic masculinity as used in campuses?
Well, I'd love to hear you
explain it.
What it means to the people who use it, because I don't really know.
Usually it is used by staunch radical feminists who basically argue that many of the instantiations of what it is to be masculine are inherently toxic, right? So if you are a risk taker and you don't channel that properly, that's a form of toxic masculinity. If the fact that males are more likely to engage in violence with one another, intrasexual fighting, right? They're not, it's not the fact that it's not domestic violence against a woman, that is a manifestation of toxic masculinity. The fact that wars are started by men, that's a manifestation of toxic masculinity. But the reality is, they really go much further. They really view the default state of being male has an inherent toxicity in it. So on the one hand, there is a kernel of truth to that. But on the other hand, it really does pathologize half of humanity of a sexually reproducing species. So I don't know if I've given you a good summary.
Well, no, that sounds good. And I mean, it's that word pathologize that is problematic, I guess, because I think it's right that if you could magically imagine that there were no such thing as males, then enormous numbers of social problems would disappear. I mean, there's no question, you know, in animals in general, males are carrying out evolutionarily adapted strategies that are normally taken at the expense of females.
Right.
And we see that, you know, much more dramatically in some species than in humans, but it certainly happens in humans in a major way as well. So if you want to call that toxic, then, you know, I understand. I mean, to say it's pathologized, of course, is wrong from the point of view of its adaptive nature, because pathology sounds like something that has gone wrong.
Well, they do think that because they believe that there is a way to intervene. It's kind of like part of the social constructivist position, right? Tabula rasa. If there's only a way for us to come up with intervention strategies to remove the toxicity of masculinity, then we would all be holding hands singing John Lennon Imagine. So I think they are coming from that perspective. There's a way to fix masculinity.
Yeah, and if the way to do it is advocated to be educating males about the deleterious consequences of their behavior for females, say, then that's not going to work, because you know, it's quite clear that there will constantly be an advantage for males who are resistant to that,
right,
sort of persuasion. And so, I mean, maybe you can imagine a world in which the control of society is so effective by those who disdain toxic masculinity that they really can control the males. But it seems that it's a very difficult imagination, and it certainly isn't going to happen simply by a little bit of extra education from kindergarten through grade school.
Right. Have you been the victim of the following cognitive bias against evolutionary explanations? It's the following, whereby if an evolutionist explains a reprehensible behavior, here are some evolutionary reasons for child abuse, the Daly and Wilson stuff. Here is an explanation. Randy Thornhill and Greg Palmer of evolution adaptation of rape. Then right away people jump on you saying, aha, you're using science in quotes to justify and condone behaviors. Usually my rebuttal is That's an idiotic position because the oncologist studies cancer and he or she are not justifying or condoning or promoting or cancer. And usually that makes these imbeciles go away. But surely as someone who has studied things that are reprehensible, male violence, then you have to have been setting yourself up to those kinds of accusations, no?
Yeah, I mean, there are certainly people who have reviled the kind of approach I take on the basis that they worry that what it's going to lead to is people accepting that males are violent and trying not to do anything, not trying to do anything about it. And so there's a group of anthropologists led by Doug Fry, Leslie Sponsel, the late Bob Sussman, who feel so strongly that it's inappropriate to let the idea out that male violence is adaptive, that right. They just want to suppress it.
Isn't this what, excuse me for interrupting you, Richard, isn't this what Steven Pinker refers to as the anthropologists of peace? That's exactly those types of folks, right?
Yes, right. There's a lovely phrase by Van der Denham, the peace and harmony mafia.
Right.
Because actually, you know, in my experience, they are pretty aggressive.
Right.
You know, I mean, it's frustrating because in some ways I cherish their approach, you know, because, you know, they're out for peace and harmony in the world. They really are.
Right.
It's just that their technique is terrible because they really seem to be wanting to suppress any kind of serious evolutionary examination of you know, the nature of males.
But I mean, that speaks to, so earlier we were talking about Levantin and Stephen Jay Gould, how they can be parasitized by their ideological biases. Well, we can push it back to Franz Boas and then all of his subsequent students who were trained in the cultural relativist approach precisely because of the noble desire to not have people misuse evolutionary explanations of biology, right? So they start off with this noble goal, but in doing so, they murder truth. And so I always tell people that I'm a truth purist, right? So that, you know, physicists study atomic energy and it can lead to the dropping of bombs on Nagasaki and Hiroshima. That doesn't mean that we shouldn't study physics because someone might misuse it. And by the same token, we can't not study biology because historical cretins might misuse it, as did the eugenicists and the social, you know, British social elitists and the Nazis, which is kind of interesting because your field of anthropology is really made up of two of the most opposing camps on that continuum. You've got the hardcore cultural relativists, and then you've got the folks like you, the biological anthropologists, who are like, yeah, no kidding, of course evolution matters. So how do you, as having had a long career in anthropology, navigate through those other guys?
I try and be respectful, okay. You know, because, I mean, it seems to me that the most important thing is to try and keep communication going. Even though emotions rise and get in the way. And so I've always, you know, tried to emphasize to my students, don't respond to these baiting comments.
Oh, and I'm sure I should come to your seminar to learn that because I get goaded and I can lose my temper. So I think I need to sign up for your seminar.
Yeah, well, I don't know how successful it is, but that's the aim. And I've got one Lewontin story I've got to give you. Sometime in the late 90s, I guess it was, I heard that there was a seminar. A student was at the seminar, first seminar of the term in a class, and it was given by Richard Lewontin and Lisa Lloyd, who is a philosopher and historian of science from Indiana. And so she was a visiting person. And anyway, Lewontin stood up at the beginning of this seminar and said, he held a copy of Demonic Males in his hand, which had published a year or two before.
Let me do the same. Here we go.
Okay. And he said, this is the kind of book that should never have been published.
were you in the room, or you were told
this?
I was
not in the room.
Okay, you were not.
But
okay.
A few days later, somebody told me about this. So I then wrote to Lewontin and Lloyd and said, I was fascinated by your approach, would you be so kind as to allow me to come to your seminar and talk to you about it? So they did. And what it turned out, and I became quite a pal, actually, of Lisa Lloyd later, you know, and we had great times together. It did turn out that neither of them had read the book.
Amazing.
At that time. And that just, you know, indicated to me how, you know, how weak this debate can be.
Yeah. Well, people are cognitive misers, right? So they just use some fast and frugal heuristic to caricature a field. And actually, that's what I was joking earlier about, you know, maintaining one's cool and so on. But that's usually what, you know, usually will trigger an irate response from me when I have fellow academics who will, you know, ape some of the ridiculous accusations against evolutionary psychology that I find truly to be offensive in the truest sense of the term. Because ultimately, look, there are things that you can criticize about the epistemology of any field, and I'm here to listen. We have to have epistemic humility and talk to one another. The problem is that it becomes a form of quasi-religion where, you know, everybody who's an evolutionary psychologist is a pseudoscientist. We sit around coming up with just-so storytelling, you know, while smoking our pipes and appearing to be profound, but we're really just grand bullshitters. And that's frustrating because it's not coming from the common person who doesn't know anything, if I may put it that way. It's coming from fellow academics. So to me, that reaction that you just gave of your two colleagues is particularly disheartening because they should know better.
Yes, and it was, I never really got to know Lewontin, But getting to know Lisa Lloyd was great because she did read the book and she said, you know, she basically had no problems with it.
Right. So I was going to actually ask you, have you had in your career in being the sort of polite, elegant British gentleman that you are, have you tended sort of bridges where some of the cultural relativists later changed their opinions and said, you know what, I'm with you here?
And I'm not quite sure how Lisa would characterize the interaction I just described, but my memory is that, you know, as I say, that was one example where it wasn't that she changed her mind, it's just that she didn't have an opinion really before.
Right.
And then, you know, once we read each other's work, we were on the same page. But in general, I think it's very depressing how little changing of minds there is.
Yeah.
And my attitude to this is basically to shrug my shoulders and say, let's keep the temperature as low as possible while discussing these issues with colleagues who've already made their mind up and hope to persuade the younger generation.
Right.
And that seems to me to be where the action really is. You know, I had an awful, a sad interaction with a very good social anthropologist called Jane Collier, who had an attitude, or her writings gave an attitude to questions about the functions of marriage from a male and a female point of view that I thought really resonated with the way I approached that question too after thinking about cooking. And I wrote to her and said, you know, I'm going to be in California, you live in San Francisco, you know, could we meet and talk about this? And she wrote back and said, my experience is that it's just absolutely hopeless having any kind of communication between our two fields. And so there's just no point in our meeting at all. Thank you very much. Goodbye.
Wow.
So, you know, she was polite enough to yeah. write. But, you know, and so it was all respectful and pleasant and so on. But it was just so sad.
Yeah. Now, do you think that that's because... So in one of my books, in The Consuming Instinct, in the first chapter, I have a whole litany of... you know, typical attacks that detractors of evolutionary thinking will levy against evolutionists. And I've expanded that list. One of the reasons, I think, so that might speak to the particular person that you just mentioned, is that evolutionary theory in general, but evolutionary psychology in particular, attacks some of the fundamental pet ideologies of people. So if I'm a postmodernist and I don't believe in an absolute truth, then I certainly don't believe in human universals. If I'm a radical feminist and who thinks that all sex differences are due to a social construction, then I certainly don't want to hear about your evolved sex differences and sexual dimorphisms, and on and on and on. So what ends up happening is that evolutionary thinking as applied to humans is no longer something that I need to tackle scientifically. It is attacking some of my fundamental ideological edifice, and therefore I hate you. I don't want to talk to you, Richard. That's exactly what this person conveyed to you in that sense.
I think that is right. And of course, you can understand it. I mean, it is very challenging because nobody wants, after several decades of working in a particular area, to have their fundamentals destroyed.
Right.
And I wouldn't like it myself, of course. And I'm sure I'd resist bitterly if someone comes along and shows somehow that Darwinian and Hamiltonian theory somehow got it wrong. I mean, you and I think that's impossible because everything fits so well.
Exactly. I actually truly think it is impossible. Although I will leave the epistemic humility door open that show me and I will change my mind. But I just can't. I always tell people there's greater evidence for evolutionary theory than there is of gravity. So that it's at that level. So if unless you want to question gravity, don't question evolution. Let's go on to cooking because I love that one because it is a perfect manifestation of how, culture interacts with biology in creating who we are. So first, give us your main thesis of that book, and then I've got a whole bunch of questions I want to ask you. Go ahead.
Well, the thesis is that the core idea is that humans are biologically adapted to eating cooked food, meaning that if we didn't eat our food cooked, we would go extinct. So it's a really severe adaptation. And I won't go through the evidence except to say that even eating really easily prepared agricultural foods, humans do really badly eating them raw. And
Badly from a health perspective.
from a health perspective, that's right. So the short story is that there is no evidence that anybody has ever survived eating raw wild food for anything more than a trivial few days, and it seems very unlikely that we could. So then the question is, how long has this adaptation been going on? And everybody in the past has taken the attitude that humans, meaning the genus Homo, sometime in the last 2 million years or so, discovered how to control fire and therefore how to cook. And this argument, I think, is wrong. I think that instead we should think that a late Australopithecine discovered the control of fire, and the consequence of that was so great that it transformed that Australopithecine into a Homo. So
Okay.
I think that the origin of the human genus lies in our control of fire.
And
And
how
then thinking about what all the effects it had.
how does your narrative how accepted is it now in relation to the other one? The two narratives that you gave, where are we at in terms of the state of affairs?
I think the great majority of people are on the fence.
Okay.
The typical paper will say that the evidence is not in, but this is an intriguing idea, something like that.
Got it.
So that's absolutely right. The evidence is not in from the point of view of archaeology. And since I wrote that book, the dates for the control of fire have gone back in time. So when I wrote it, the earliest convincing dates were sometime around 400,000 years. Now, then they went to 800,000 years. They went to 1 million years. There's a paper at 1.6 now, which is they think they've got it there. I hear whispers of other papers. So I'm hoping it's going to go back, but it hasn't gone back all the way yet. But on the other hand, if you think about the biological evidence. And the biological evidence to me is the fact that with the evolution of Homo erectus, you've got a species that had a relatively small gut, starting with small teeth and small mouth. a species also that was clearly sleeping on the ground. Nobody, I think, has got satisfactory explanations for that other than that they were controlling fire and therefore that enabled them to have a softer kind of food that required less chewing and a more digestible kind of food that allowed a smaller gut.
Right. I listened to one of your lectures where you were discussing some research from, I think, I might be getting the details wrong, you'll correct me. I think it was Japanese dentists or dental researchers with the mastication, sort of how much caloric requirement or energy it takes to masticate either, cooked foods or not. Could you
you know what?
You don't remember that study?
Thinking about that.
Okay, so I'll look. If I find it, I will put it in the description section. I wanted to jump to a related field. So, you study, cooking as an adaptation. There is a field called Darwinian gastronomy, actually from the guy who's the main guy, Sherman, is actually a guy from my alma mater at Cornell. So he studies how culinary traditions vary around the world as adaptation. So in a sense, he's taking a behavioral ecological approach, demonstrating the fact that culture itself doesn't exist in lieu of biology. Cultural forms exist because of biology, right? And so, for example, how much spice use you use in a culinary tradition is correlated to the ambient temperature in that ecosystem because of, the proliferation of food pathogens, so the antimicrobial properties and so on. So how do you fit, your cooking as an adaptation with that behavioral ecological approach? How do these two overlap?
Well, as you say, I mean, they're both examples of the interaction of culture and biology. The biology in the spice example is that we are vulnerable to the bacteria that live on meat. And so culturally, we've acquired the habit of using hot spices or actually a whole variety of spices that tend to control bacteria.
Yeah.
And so that habit has not come about through natural selection. It's come about through some kind of cultural selection. And without anybody realizing it, it's had this biological function.
Yes.
So biology and culture intertwined fascinatingly. Cooking, of course, is an entwinement because what you see with cooking is that nowadays where people absolutely rely on cooked food to be able to get enough energy into their bodies, that reflects the fact that the body has adapted to the availability of cooked food, which originally was a purely cultural consequence.
Right.
And actually, of course, remains a cultural consequence from the point of view of the production of the food. So we don't have any biology that directs us towards cooking food, other than hunger for it. But that's something that happens in other species as well. Apes and carnivores and that sort of thing, they all like their food cooked if they can get it.
Right.
But what we have is an adaptation of our bodies as a consequence of our cultural traits.
Right. Now, you, in your work, because I'm going to link now to a very contentious topic, as I told you offline, some of the scariest folks to get, to trigger their ire are the vegan brigade. And so at one point I had, gotten into some scuffle with someone, and I decided to, let me go and do a sad truth clip on my channel where I demonstrate all of the lines of evidence that seem to support the idea that we were, a meat-eating animal in our evolutionary history. And here what I did is something that you will appreciate, is what I call as nomological networks of cumulative evidence. The idea being that if you want to demonstrate the veracity of an evolutionary argument, try to look for completely distinct lines of evidence across cultures, across time periods, across disciplines, across paradigms, across methodologies. And if they all point to the same final conclusion, then it's becoming really difficult for you to attack my otherwise unassailable position. Now, Charles Darwin had done that without calling it nomological networks of cumulative evidence, precisely by, over a couple of decades, collecting data from animal husbandry and paleontology and geology and so on and so forth. So I actually took a screenshot of that Sad Truth clip where I was trying to build, if you like, a nomological network for the evidence that humans are certainly have evolved to eat meat. So I'm just going to list the disciplines. So I offered anatomical evidence, physiological evidence, morphological evidence, including cranial and dental, paleobiological evidence, parasitological evidence, archaeological, cross-cultural evidence, anthropological evidence, comparative morphology, nutritional, genomic analysis, genetics, medical, sexual, and psychological. And despite my very assiduous attempts to show that humans are a, meat-eating animal, all I got was unbelievable animus from the view. As a matter of fact, usually my like to dislike ratios on my Twitter, on my YouTube channel, is in the order of 99% positive. These were the only clips I've ever posted, over 1,000 clips, where they sent basically every vegan in the world to smash my channel, and I have more thumbs down than thumbs up. So having said that, you're the big expert, certainly one of the big experts. Have humans evolved to eat meat or not?
So there's the vitamin B12, which comes from animals, and we absolutely need it. We suffer without it. So that suggests that we've always had some kind of animal food intake. I'm sort of slightly surprised about your list of sources. So, for instance, with an anatomy.
Yes.
I'm not convinced that there's any kind of anatomical evidence for us eating meat.
So then I will have to send you the link to, because I can't say it off the top of my head, and then you'll maybe even post a comment to either to the contrary or in support. I couldn't tell you off the top of my head, but go ahead.
Okay, so a lot of the evidence that used to be adduced, and sometimes still is, for biological adaptations to meat eating in our species, I think can be reinterpreted in terms of cooking.
I see.
So people have often said that we have a relatively short gut and carnivores have relatively short guts. The fact that carnivores have short guts is intriguing because you can't find many animals that do. But there are no other animals that are adapted to cooking. And our guts are quite clearly good enough for cooking. To me, the real issue is with veganism, is it raw veganism or cooked veganism? So my perspective on meat eating is that it's been immensely valuable, that humans have always done it. And I think some of the genetic evidence that you just referred to, genetic evidence as one of the sources, that may indeed suggest that we have got adaptations to some kinds of meat eating. But we can't eat a lot of protein.
Right.
We suffer from eating too much protein. And to me, the really important aspect of meat eating is as a source of fat.
Right.
So it's the big animals that provided a relatively high proportion of fat as a source of calories in their bodies that would have been very important for the human evolution. I don't think that the evolution of the genus Homo can be ascribed to meat eating. And one of the reasons for that is that our teeth just look quite wrong for it.
Right, got you. I was going to say that in the list that I gave you, the sort of the distinct line of evidence, one of them is the idea that the hunter-gatherer theory of sex differences when it comes to, say, movement versus memory location stems from an implicit recognition that men are better at certain physical tasks because they would have evolved them from the hunter-gatherer role specialization. Another one would be that in many cultures, it is a sexual signal to be a good hunter. So that would have been channeled through a mechanism of sexual selection. And so when I was trying to develop that nomological network, as someone who is not an expert in that particular field, that's how my brain was working. Can I come up with completely distinct lines of evidence across an incredibly broad range of disciplines that point to it? And to me, it seemed like I had done a good job. But hopefully, if you get a chance to watch it, maybe you'll correct some of the errors that I might have made.
Okay, but you know, I'm totally comfortable with the notion that hunter-gatherers have always had a difference between men's and women's foraging activities, with men going after high-risk, high-gain items, and that those high-risk, high-gain items would mostly have been things you hunt.
Right.
So, but that's not quite the same thing as saying that we have evolved to hunt.
Right. Yeah. Yes. Yes. I get that distinction. Yes. Very good. Okay. Let's move on to your latest book, The Goodness Paradox. Now, it sounds like, I don't know if you're aware of this. Last week, I'm not sure if he's your most illustrious student. I don't want to put you on the spot, but certainly one of your illustrious students, Brian Hare, on the show.
Okay.
And by the way, he says hello to you. And there's another hello coming your way from Michael Shermer, a common friend, who insisted. I was at his house just before the COVID in Santa Barbara, and we were going through some of the books in his in his personal library, and we came across one of your books, and he said, "Oh, you really need to have Richard on your show." So I need to publicly thank him for having. So Brian has a book that, as you know, recently came out called "Survival of the Friendliest." What are some things that in your arguments that are similar, and is there any place where you depart? Maybe you can give us your thesis and contextualize it in light of some of your students' work.
So, as you probably know, we thought about this very much together. Yes. In the early years, where do we differ? We differ because Brian is interested in the consequences of self-domestication.
Could you explain what that is?
Oh, self-domestication is humans becoming like a domesticated animal and actually undergoing biological processes that are the same as happen in many domesticated animals, all organized by a reduction in the propensity for reactive aggression, a reduction in the tendency to lose your temper. So much less impulsive, much more inhibited, and enormous consequences for psychology, including tolerance and the ability to cooperate. The parallel features in the biology between what's happened with humans and what happens in domesticated animals are beginning to be revealed in the genetics of this. So the same genes are involved in making a dog out of a wolf as making a human out of an ancestor that had the same genes as Neanderthals and Denisovans.
This is, if I can interject for a moment, Richard, this is sort of the pleiotropic story, right? This is the silver foxes where we're doing the artificial selection for docility. And by selecting on that behavioral trait, you see the downstream effect of morphological features that kind of correlate with docility, the floppy ears, the bigger eyes, and so on. So are you making the same argument, but instead of a animal husbandry doing the selection, we're doing the self-domestication on humans? Is that the general idea?
Yes. So that's well said, that when you select on to reduce aggressiveness and fear and aggressiveness in foxes or mink or rats or chickens or mice, then, as people have done experimentally, then you get a whole series of consequences that pop up by surprise, except you might have expected them because other domesticated animals have them, like white patches of fur and floppy ears and changes in the skeleton and the skull. And so this is the domestication syndrome. And humans turn out to have a domestication syndrome in relationship to our earlier ancestors, at least as judged by the bones, which is all that we've got. And so if that, if we are domesticated like those other domesticated animals, then how did it happen? Answer, nobody domesticated us. We had to do it ourselves. So we were self-domesticated.
How? So what's the mechanism? Is it through female mate choice? What's the mechanism?
So this is where Brian and I disagree.
Ah, good. Okay.
Brian thinks it was something to do with higher population density, perhaps.
Higher density implies more likelihood for violence, lower density, less violence?
No. Well, higher density in his world would mean that you all have to get along and live together.
Oh, right. Okay. Yes.
And
yes.
So you kind of tone it down a bit.
Yes.
I follow the work of this fascinating biological anthropologist, cultural anthropologist, really, Christopher Boehm.
Yes.
So he has reviewed literature that was reviewed quite a lot before him as well, but he's put it in a biological context, showing that in small-scale societies, places where you have no police, you have no state to intervene, you're just a small group living out there on your own, if somebody is troublingly aggressive, then after you have ridiculed them and tried to shut them up by refusing to talk to them and cajoling them and all the things that you might try, but after those all fail, then what does that society do? It executes them.
Right.
And what Boehm has argued is that capital punishment has been a longstanding feature of humans, and that once it evolved as a cultural phenomenon, then what it led to was a genetic selection against the propensity for aggressiveness. Mm. And I think that's right. That this is the key that gave rise, or that led to the origin of Homo sapiens. Because here's an amazing thing. There is no real theory until now, I think, of the origin of Homo sapiens. Homo sapiens is the biggest brain of the Homo species, and most people have something along these lines that, as they got bigger brained, culture became more important, tools became more important, they could afford to have slightly slenderer skeletons, they were using using tools to make their food more easily available, so you didn't have to have quite such big teeth, shorter faces were possible. So they attribute the various changes that you see in Homo sapiens to culture. Here we've got a different explanation. And this explanation is that language came to the point where people could whisper together and say, that guy is a real bastard. We need to do something about him. We're going to conspire together, right, plan, and kill him. And so that's the theory that I embrace, Homo sapiens owes its origins to the development of capital punishment.
Interesting. Now, in one of the sections of my forthcoming book, I talk about the power of satire. So when you're dealing with despots and dictators, and you, I'm not sure if you follow any of my work, one of the persuasion tools that I use is that I like to think that I'm a very, very adept satirist, at least in certainly satirizing and mocking all the idea pathogens that we see on university campuses. Now, in a sense, that speaks to the fact that when it comes to the despots who are trying to control all those aggressive males that might want to otherwise get to you, they're not going after the guys with the big muscles. They're not the ones that scare them. The guys that scare them are the ones with the big brains, the ones with the ability to satirize them. And that's why we usually, if I'm a despot or a dictator, I want to get rid of the really smart guys, the ones who can mock, who can satirize me, before I worry about the guys with the big muscles. How does that idea fit in within your sort of goodness, narrative?
I think it speaks to a time after you have got rid of alpha males.
Okay.
So, what I go back to is the notion that until you have Homo sapiens, at a time when you had these more robust Homo heidelbergensis, big wide face, big brawny people, they were very likely to living in a society like chimpanzees, baboons, gorillas, even bonobos, in which the alpha male was able to physically suppress all of the other males in the group.
Right.
So all of the males were afraid of the alpha male. They're afraid of getting beaten up by him. And so to me, the big change is the point at which the beta males, all of them, could get together and do something about somebody who could terrorize them individually.
Right.
Now the reason that your scenario, the reason that someone with a big brain is scary is because they're able to manipulate the coalitions very cunningly. Right. But that doesn't happen until you've got to the point where you can manipulate the coalitions at all.
Right, right. So what would be... I can easily see how a lot of those explanations can come across as speculative and post hoc, just so storytelling to the detractors that we were talking about earlier. So what would be the typical strategy? I mean, I know the types of methodologies I use when I'm doing my work, right? If I want to study how the ovulatory cycle affects women's consumer choices, well, I track women longitudinally over their menstrual cycles and I keep track of what they've done and so on. And hopefully it becomes unassailable that my position is hopefully correct. What are some of those lines of evidence that I was talking about earlier that you would typically collect to support your position so that you can protect against the just-so-story speculative stuff?
Well, you know, we know that in small-scale societies throughout the world, capital punishment has been the device to get rid of excessively aggressive men. You know, that's a fact. And so it's not a matter of speculation that this has been a part of human society. And to me, the real question is, how long has it been going on?
Right.
Well, we have a way of getting an answer to that. And that is that the genes for domestication that we share with domesticated animals, the prediction is that in Neanderthals and Denisovans, you are not going to find those genes.
Got it.
Because Neanderthals and Denisovans are on a separate trajectory where they retain the Pleistocene morphology that is indicative of a species that has not got this reduced aggressiveness.
Got it.
And what is so exciting is that evidence is already coming in.
So this is to use the terms that, from biology, you're seeing a homologous trait across species that supports what you're saying, but you're not seeing that homologous trait in those other, quote, human species, correct? Is that right? Okay,
that's right. So in a Homo neanderthalensis and Homo denisovensis, or whatever it's called, we have their complete genomes. And so, you know, that is incredibly exciting because it means that you can test this hypothesis. You can say, you know, the test is very clear that the genes that the sapiens shares with domesticated animals will not be found in Neanderthals and Denisovans.
That's fantastic.
And the early tests are already showing that to be true.
Wow. So, Darwin did what he did without being able to study things at that level of analysis. I mean, in a sense, it only mystifies how amazing he is that he doesn't have that data, right?
Yeah, right. But, you know, I mean, how incredibly fortunate it is. And, I mean, Denisovans have only been known for, I can't remember, 15 years or something. Neanderthals, of course, are much longer. But we have, really great specimens from Neanderthals and a few from Denisovans. And so, you know, this is an incredibly powerful test. And I think one of the most exciting things that's going on at the moment is, in general, the understanding of the genetic basis of domestication in animals, because you have 25 different phylogenies. You know, you've got dogs and wolves, you've got horses and wild horses, you've got cats and wild cats, and so on. And so to be able to get parallel genetic adaptations in all of these different independent lines will give you extremely strong understanding of what domestication does and its genetic control. And that means that you have an extremely strong test for humans compared to Neanderthals and Denisovans.
Well, see, this what you're just describing exactly speaks to why I get so angry when people levy the just so story business. Because the reality is, if anything, evolutionists set the evidentiary bar usually much higher than you would typically see in other sciences. Yet we are accused of the exact opposite, right? We're just cognac sipping, pipe smoking guys with our velvet suits coming up with fanciful stories, but really we're pretending to be doing science, but we're just a bunch of, excuse the term, glorious bullshitters. And it's the exact opposite that is guiding our epistemology. So I hope that some of the people who are listening to this chat will sort of stray away from that really, to my mind, vulgar accusation.
I mean,
Richard, go
it's a
ahead.
fascinating world we're getting into because, this is clearly going to be the century of the genome.
Right.
The work that is going to be done will be very scary to a lot of people because, we're surely going to learn in complex and unanticipatable ways the degree to which genetics has underpinned human adaptations.
Do you think there will ever be a time, notwithstanding the genetic unit of analysis, do you ever foresee a time where the marriage of psychology and biology, as someone who studies, consumer psychology and as an evolution psychologist, do you ever see that marriage becoming normal science in the Kuhnian sense? Like everybody will say, yeah, no kidding, of course humans are driven by biology. Or do you think it is just part of our natural makeup to always resist the idea that the same evolutionary forces that shape all of the other species also shape us? We want to somehow look or think of ourselves as transcending our biology. What are your thoughts on that?
I'm not enough of a social psychologist or whatever to be able to answer that, in the future. I mean, the future is going to be so different in all sorts of ways by the time we've got chips implanted in our brains and technology has revolutionized the way we reproduce and so on. I'm not comfortable with the notion that the discoveries will lead to the conclusion that biology is driving us so much as that culture is very rarely going to be totally independent of biology.
Well, that's the E.O. Wilson genes hold culture on a leash story, right?
Yeah, exactly. Exactly. So, it seems to me that it's incumbent on us to be careful of our language because people get scared when they hear a phrase like biology drives us. I mean, in some ways it does, but in ordinary life, I mean, it may determine how much food we eat on a regular basis, or how much how strong our motivation is for sex. But obviously, there's endless ways in which the subtlety of the relationship between biology and culture is enormous.
Of course. Richard, of course, I could keep you here for another 5 hours, but I'm mindful of your time. Last question are there any projects that you're working on that you'd like to use this opportunity to maybe promote or talk about, something that people don't necessarily know about, the next book you're working on, or anything that you want? Take it away.
I mean, the thing that I am thinking about at the most at the moment, whether or not it'll turn into a book, I'm not sure, is what I would call deep patriarchy. I think that people are slightly too single-minded about sex differences in size and muscularity. Thinking about that aspect of where patriarchy comes from, I
By
think
deep,
it's
you're talking about deep evolutionary time. That's how you're using the term deep. Okay. Got it.
So most of the evolutionary approaches to patriarchy focus on just the fact that males are bigger and more muscular. And I think that there's something much deeper than that, which is that I think that males are very good at forming coalitions with each other that they can then use to control society and control women. in a way that has gone back to the beginning of Homo sapiens.
Yeah, there's a term for that. It's called religion.
Well, religion, I mean, religion is incredibly male, of course. The law is incredibly male.
Right.
In fact, you know, all of these major institutions are incredibly male. And so I guess what I want to do is to link that to the arguments in the goodness paradox about the control of alpha males by beta males acting in coalition.
Right.
And then once they have learned how to control an alpha male, they've realized that they've learned the ability to control anybody in the society. And that coalition of males is the force that has imposed itself on the evolution of human society in a way that and that it continues to do. And I think it's always done it. And if we want to, as I do, to see a fairer world from the point of view of do you happen to be born male or female, and what kind of opportunities do you have in life, then I think it behooves us to recognize this persistent and, if you like, toxic social ability of males to control society.
I can't decide based on what you just described whether you're going to really anger the feminists or make them really happy. That's to be determined.
I want to know.
Richard, stay on the line just so we can say goodbye offline. It was such a pleasure having you. You're a true delight. Michael Shermer was not wrong in recommending that we chat. So thank you, Michael, and thank you, Richard, for coming on the show.
You're a wonderful host. Thank you so much.
Thank you, sir.